This would be an infinitely more powerful instrument of persuasion and control than fact. With our burgeoning experience of cyberspace, we can now see that this may well be the direction an advanced intelligence might take. Alien lifeblood may well be based on image suggestion rather than exchange of factual information. In accordance with the emerging moral nature of Adamski's era, the bland responses of the space folk exhibit as little radical curiosity as does Adamski himself. He would have been a difficult man to fool over the grocery bill, the tax demand, or the garage repair. But most contactees do not seem to mind that the voices from space seem to lack any old gods, idiot gods, or plain daft and silly gods, all of which the Greeks had in plenty. Neither do their gods have any chronically ill, or mad, or any difficult young, nor do they have any renegade souls, and they lack all sign of any downright bloody-minded subversives. They lack all humor also. Adamski's 103 crews have an irritating zen-like calm, and the messages given to him have the depth of the instructions on the back of a stir-fry pack. Thankfully, there are a few hints of trouble in paradise, but this is expressed with the sort of emotional force that censors neighbors who do not clean their windows often enough or leave broken-down pickups in the road, jacked up on bricks, and minus a wheel or two. There are also hints as to what happens to those very few space gods who have not seen the light. These misguided spirits are subjected to spiritual eugenics. Helen and Brian Reeve, the authors of Flying Saucer Pilgrimage, speak of house cleaning in the higher vibratory regions of outer space as easily as talking of washing their curtains and chair covers, and with just about the same range of emotions. These space folk who speak so casually of magnetic vibrations and etheric matter transfer, are therefore nice chintz cushion and flock wallpaper gods. They are very definitely not the bleeding to death, treacherous, or kick in the backside gods of Shakespeare, Nietzsche, or Mount Olympus. These space folk gods are the nice boy scout deities of patio and lawn. They are the guardian spirits of regularly washed curtains, and neat hedgerows. The gods of a landscape tamed, and their air petulant bleats could be from Donald Duck at Extremely Lurb. It is extremely odd that Adamski did not contact the elemental beings of his own mountain home. Given his early hippie prototype New Age views, this is surprising. The beings he meets are not from rock, cloud, or forest. They are mechanical, industrial, and electromagnetic to a fault. They are the gods of an age that in Adamski's time was already dying on its feet. 50 years later, with an intense suspicion of mechanistic science, we see that what Adamski saw was far too optimistic. The message was that the future would form a seamless blend between science and progress. His beings as projected are successful scientists who are spiritually advanced at the same time. None of this came about, and technology shrunk to invisibility. If Adamski was duped, he was duped by feedback of his own best expectations. But his simple-minded romanticism sees no dangers in the absence of the tortuous paradoxes of all higher mental complexity. In the mall-like spaceship, there is no blood on the paradigms. It would appear that 104 Adamski has entered his own gestalt, a kind of mall simulation. All parties in the exchange appear to have become mall products themselves. As shown in their book, Flying Saucer Pilgrimage, the Reeves in particular have almost shrunk their gods to medicinal house goblins, who give moral precepts about as valuable as wart cures. We are talking, of course, of the early 1950s, when the first malls were being built, and being built in prosperous America alone. Such things had not yet reached Europe, whose war-shocked consumer gods at that time had not yet come out of the closet. When the early British space gods do appear percent, they are still the rather tired and weary rough-hewn deities of hill and grove, ready reluctantly to bow out somewhat reluctantly for Adamsk-1's synthetic dolls. Thus contact may not be in terms of either greys or spindly war of the world's machines spouting laser death rays, but in the cool form of that powerful suggestion virus called the advertisement. Advanced life might be indeed as vaporous as a mere power metaphor that dines on belief batteries as inevitably as cattle chew the cud. poor Adamski again. His hosts didn't ask him to sign his name in blood, they just asked him to believe in the clapboard frontage of their 5- and 10-cent store, and not ask who or what was signing the checks. February 19, 1953 at 5:10 a.m. The spectacular evening ends with Bogart back in his lonely room in the existential city. I sat on the edge of the bed for a full hour, writes Adamski, reviewing the experiences of the night. And even as they went through my mind, I could not help but reflect on how fantastic the thing would seem to my fellow man. Nevertheless, I must tell of it, could scarcely believe in the reality of all that had happened in the past few hours. Yet I knew what my eyes had seen and my ears had heard, and that without doubt it had been a completely physical experience. As a Nian dedicated to theosophy, Adamski might have borne in mind Immanuel Swedenborg's warning, when the angels begin to speak to a man, he must beware, for they will prattle of such outrageous nonsense as would never be believed. April 21, 1953. The same strange feeling. By this time, Adamski's manuscript must have been ready to fly across the Atlantic to Werner 105 lorry. Same hotel, same chatty waiter, lo, a smiling Firkin arrives, and like a chief scout, gives him a special code word. Adamski finds a cozy booth just for two, and Firkin orders a peanut butter sandwich on whole wheat, black coffee, and a piece of apple pie. Again, we wonder about Adamski sometimes in this respect. He seems to like being smothered by well-proportioned young men, invariably handsome and with an air of confident superiority. In their presence, he is reduced to a wide-eyed childish wonder. All over the world, he prefers small out-of-town hotels for his accommodation, saying that these are suitable places to meet the boys, as he always refers to visiting spacemen. Biographer Lou Zinstagnut Adamski's ill-concealed excitement when, in a Swiss bar in 1959, he sees a tanned man wearing dark glasses with his blonde hair brushed over his forehead. She checks discreetly on Adamski's hotel visitors, and finds that he has regular callers, all male. If we believe they were all spacemen, we'll believe anything. For after all, Adamski describes the space folk as creative men and women who take a delight in styling and making clothes. There are other telling gems, such as the rather blushing admission from Desmond Leslie in the Cosmic Bulletin of the Adamski Foundation, "One don't suppose he will mind me telling this, now he has cast off the fine old body, but he once showed me the most extraordinary birthmark. His navel was not like a human navel at all. It was a huge solar disk with deeply cut rays extending out about 6 inches all around it from waist to groin. What this signifies I have no idea, unless it is truly the sign of a child of the Sunday back in the Los Angeles hotel. The food may be good, but the conversation leaves a lot to be desired," says Firkin. "Between bites, we of other worlds who have been living unrecognized amongst you can see clearly how identity with divine origin has been lost. People of Earth have become separate entities which are no longer truly human in expression as in the beginning they were. Then into same black Pontiac. Different mothership, but same dialogue and the recurring Adamski theme, a greeting from a handsome man. This man he names Zul. And Zul is as disappointing as Firkin. He gives out more pasteurized talk about the Divine Father, some Barnum and Bailey bits about Jesus, and a haughty Martian lady speaks early middle Barbuella, you Earth people do not desire to show such cruelty towards one another. This, as you have been told before, is merely the result of your self-ignorance, which in turn blinds you to the laws of the universe of which we are all a part. After that, more rail balconies and elevators come as a relief. Adamski, when he ceases his constipated religious mouthing, can be interesting. He describes a laboratory straight out of Mary Poppins, full of the kind of control panels, graphs, colored lights, and screens seen on the lurid covers of Astounding Science Fiction magazine of those days. The control panel, from the days of the earliest railway signal boxes to the array in front of the pilots of the space shuttle, is a unique 20th century motif. One day, just like the gargoyles of Chartres and Notre Dame, the changing shapes and complexity of these ever-evolving discs and boxes will be read as indicators of the AI ideology of power and social control. They too will be seen as the shapes of thought and being, intellectual achievement and moral order of nature as it was lovingly conceived once upon a time. Control panels are the religious relics and mythological tableaus of an age of technological uncertainty, just as the increasingly nervous late medieval universe was full of theological fear. The walls of Occam's enclosed universe were to fall before the trumpet blasts of early experimental science. Much later, Francis Bacon's objective view was greeted with the same kind of spleen Adamski-type ideas now still receive. Very few authors can combine factional techno-fairy tales in the typical naive Adamski manner, and make also a work of valuable literary concept art in the genre we now call pan-dimensional. Adamski's life and personality both are pure image stuff, fodder for Warhol and Dali dreams. Like the contactees Howard Menger and Frank Strange's, he accepts without question ludicrously comic and deliciously crazy experiences. He does not laugh, question, or criticize, and never is he suspicious. On a screen in one of the spaceships, he is shown a close-up of the surface of the moon, and sees a four-legged and furry animal scurrying around. He was a sucker for any programmatic agenda. Today he would perhaps be honored as a media freak. He was just waiting to be filled up night and day with new dreams, and explode them all over the planet like metaphor spores. If computers, mixed media, and 24-track mixing desks had been available, he would have dragged the lot up the mountain and blown the mountain apart. If we roar with laughter, we might bear in mind that without human living rainforests like Adamski, we are all dead. Of course, he went far beyond the stage of eccentric entertainer. His boxes of tricks did not stop traveling from faction to fact via fantasy, and then back again by way of fiction. This process of discovery is a classic alchemical progress. In this, he achieved a collective discovery of himself. He didn't need acid or marijuana. He cared little for alcohol, money, or even fame. He tripped on new images alone. They were the manner of his intensely spiritual life. If he was chosen for this kind of experience, then this is the reason why. As such, he took in anything and everything. He is a loincloth native fascinated by cheap trash as well as high mysteries ; 99 the most elementary gimmickry has his eyes bulging. He praises seats that are raised by a foot pedal, the pilot suits of the women, the silent sliding doors, and the colored screens that are displaying information from the scout discs that are roving the earth. The spaceship nears the moon, which is shown on a screen to have fertile valleys. But when we are about to give up hope for poor Adamski, there occurs one of those frightening moments when he gets the technological future right on target. We must remember that he predicated the existence of the Van Allen belt of space radiation, and later astronauts confirmed the outer space fireflies he said that he had seen on his trips. Now this untutored cheeky chappy who broke all the rules almost gets it right about future computer programming, VHF telemetry, and digital communications. There are remotely controlled scout discs going in and out of the motherships, and six girls by means of keys like an organ feed instructions and flight data to them, which they retain. Pretty early stuff for the time of the composition of / inside the spaceships, whose American edition appeared in 1955, but just as we are getting interested in all this, just as it begins to gain a little of what we might call verisimilitude, yet another master more camp than the first arrives to give more jukebox religion. But what this particular master said was to prove ominous for Adamski. Now that we have been 108 together in this way, you can the more easily at all times make contact from your mind to ours. Remember always that space is no barrier. This means that there is going to be telepathic communication. This was the idea that was to drive Adamski nearly insane before he died, and cause the collapse of much of his worldwide support. But as far as any possible alien intelligence was concerned, the changes in metaphor had been initiated. The story virus had spread throughout the world, and the world was not the same place after the appearance of flying saucers have landed. As for the conspiracy, it had disappeared, enfolded within a deception. Eventually Adamski was left high and dry with a few threads of possibility within possibilities. From this thin fabric, he tried to sculpt the faces of the gods and their tale of tales. The Argentinian fantasist Jorge Borges, alive and well at this time, and not all that far away, would have loved all this had he come across this cutting edge of a new culture, but if he knew of it, he ignored it. The great writers of Adamski's day ignored it also. They were absorbed in largely obsolete literary conventions and unaware of the pan-dimensional texts those non-literary writers such as Adamski were weaving out of myth, popular culture, and the newly emerging technological imagination. Thus did the very last generation of great writers miss out on the first wave of quite unprecedented changes in the world. Writers such as Norman Mailer and Tom Wolfe are almost contemptuously silent on the flying saucer, as were Allen Ginsberg, Jack Kerouac, and surprisingly, Timothy Leary. Chapter 9. The Last Contact. September 1, 1953. Adamski feels that great urgency again. The publication in Britain of Flying Saucers Have Landed is only weeks away, but he does not talk about how he looked forward to that event. No, he is back in the same Los Angeles hotel, a glutton for punishment. He dines out again with Firkin and Ramu, but this time there is no apple pie, just sandwiches and coffee, and the jovial waiter is nowhere to be seen. They are served by a cordial waitress who interrupts only to fill their coffee cups. The coffee was certainly needed, for there is yet more consumer metaphysics about divine laws, the Creator, and something called all knowledge. The content gets slightly more interesting, however, because for the first time, Adamski asks hard questions about the death of Captain Mandel, a National Guard pilot who died chasing a UFO in his P-51 Mustang, for instance. But Adamski gets some evasive answers. By the time he returns to his hotel, he is now a junkie, and can't wait for his next fix of more religion, USA. Not long after this meeting, he is again traveling to Los Angeles, filled with joyous anticipation like Tarchild before Christmas. But again there is the ominous note, now amplified. The mental communications from my friends of other planets were becoming more and more definite as time went on. Ramu greets him at the usual hotel. Firkin couldn't make it, and Ramu apologizes for him. Same Pontiac, same Saturnian scout ship, but this time, Ramu says that the visit has been requested by the Master himself, and that the whole of the trip will be not a tour, but a long session with the Master. In the face of this awesome prospect of another ball-breaking speech, Adamski must have been not a little relieved at meeting a posse of beautiful Saturnian women. But just as Ramu says there is quite a bit of activity on the part of your Air Force tonight, the Master arrives to break it all up. All of Adamski's masters have a serious problem. They must be amongst the most boring and crass-brained individuals ever born. This one in particular wouldn't make the ratings at a downtown Salvation Army bun for a prayer meeting just before the addicts and the drunks are thrown out and the cops are called. He is possessed by a kind of green-blooming pond algae of the mind for which a sock on the jaw might have come as a relief to him and all concerned. Here he is in full flight, giving all earthlings the usual kicking. A great fallacy which has grown on the people of Earth is the custom of dividing into many parts that which should never be divided. You have multiple divisions in forms and teachings, many firm likes and dislikes, all of which serve only to add to the state of confusion on your planet. In other words, the Master does not like those wonderful conflicts, paradoxes and tragicomic catastrophes that alone make life worth living. His hostility to fuzzy-minded hairy-assed humanity is a seamless piece of moral muzak. If this candy was produced by a higher intelligence, then it could be nothing more or less than a comic mimicking of Adamski's own religious philosophizing for the purpose of entertainment alone. These ruminations about the earth, man, and the supreme intelligence come to an end with the kind of sentiment that has led the world to absolute disaster on countless occasions. Ramu, speaking of the Master, says, he is one of the most evolved beings still functioning within our system. Just to be in his presence is to grow in love and understanding. We are all fortunate. Adamski asks Ramu if the Master contacted him telepathically and asked him to come along on this occasion. Yes, answers Ramu, your own ability to receive is growing. We now know how fortunate this growing ability was for Adamski, because eventually, these space chapel voices in his head were to almost destroy him, mentally, physically, and professionally. All these mighty confusions were, as we shall see, the stuff of personal tragedy involving interaction with the great visionary and technological schemes of his time and culture. Almost a year later, August 23, 1954. The Last Contact. Flying Saucers Have Landed has now been published, and both Adamski and Desmond Leslie are in great demand. On this date, the visiting Desmond Leslie is away lecturing in Los Angeles. Adamski says that he tried to get Leslie aboard, but the Space Brothers wouldn't have him. What a disappointment for Leslie. He missed the farewell cake and the sexy dance, which made a wonderful change from impenetrable discussions about universal brotherhood, holy writ, and the age of Aquarius. Unfortunately, on this trip the Master is back, and gives forth a blast about the right path. If this is enlightenment, then the Earth is in far greater danger than even Adamski ever thought. Another perfect Bogart scene. Adamski finds himself back in his lonely hotel room in deep withdrawal. This time the fix hasn't worked so well. The pushers are holding back and increasing their prices. There is a monkey is on his back, it won't go away, and the new world he has found is starting to eat him alive. We can hardly blame him. He was on the edge of an emerging cosmos where all events and significances were to become disposable, virtual, or hyperreal. Some 30 years later, Baudrillard describes well the Los Angeles to which Adamski traveled from his magic mountain to meet his spacemen and women. Los Angeles is a town whose mystery is precisely that it is nothing more than a network of endless unreal circulation, a town of fabulous proportions, but without space or dimensions. As much as electrical and nuclear power stations, as much as film studios, this town, which is nothing more than an immense script and a perpetual motion machine, needs this old imaginary makeup of childhood signals and fake phantasms for its sympathetic nervous system. And so, as Adamski leaves his metaphysical city, the story of these trips comes to an end. However, in an unexpected postscript at the end of Inside the Spaceships, Adamski makes a move straight out of Citizen Kane. He describes dashing into his publishers even as the presses are rolling on this book, possessed by yet another funny feeling. April 25, 1955. The frame of reference All Day Yesterday gives this whole episode the feeling of a surreal time sequence in a science fiction novel. Unable to sleep, Adamski tells us he caught a coach to Los Angeles, but this time he carried his own Polaroid camera, apparently with the space folks' prior permission. An unnamed brother he has not seen before greets him at the hotel, but warns him that the magnetic fields inside the spaceship might interfere drastically with the pictures. Once inside the ship, this brother takes the Polaroid, saying that he will take the pictures while Adamski has a chat with Orthon, who has appeared almost on cue. Three of the pictures taken with this camera appear in the British edition of Inside the Spaceships, published in 1956. What a story. And it has not been done. The life, the vision, and the contacts, neither film nor television makers have touched the confusions and the tragedy. Writing in 1970, Desmond Leslie comments, George, damn it, I once expostulated. Do you swear by all that's sacred that you are telling the truth? Desmond, he answered quietly, you know my religious beliefs. One of these days I shall have to face my maker. Do you think I'd dare face him with a lie like that on my conscience? There was no doubting the man's sincerity. However, even telling Leslie that those guys were human just like you and me on occasion, Adamski would hedge his bets, if only to confuse, as was his way. When he last saw Leslie shortly before his death in 1965, he was still unwilling to admit anything other than a flesh and blood series of contacts. But Leslie does admit that on one occasion, Adamski said no one of us could be taken to another planet in our system and see the home world of its inhabitants in his present bodily form or condition. Much rich comedy has been provided over the years by many and varied attempts at constructing a single, elegant, unified solution to the UFO problem. Explanatory offerings have been as mad as anything Adamski had to offer. They range from Earth lights resulting from geomagnetic strain and electromagnetic pollution to J. Allen Hynek's swamp gas explanation for the 1966 UFO sightings over Michigan. The very British psychosocial explanations, now fortunately howled off the international stage, have been particularly hilarious. If we reverse the psychosocial equations, then we have a much better focus. Laboratory rats may not be the only creatures within an experimental maze. Certainly contact with an alien intelligence will rid us of all previous ideas of what intelligence is, and how it works. If we dismiss Adamski, it must be remembered that from his time onwards, the Western world became a huge doll's house, just like the inside of his spaceships, and gradually the entertainment media complex becoming integrated with the military-industrial complex. Those who scoff at the idea of fairy kingdoms might well consider that our own entertainment state is such a kingdom come about. Some cynics would say that the inside of the media entertainment head is identical to the interiors of Adamski's spaceships. Both are doll's house machines with plenty of blood around if we happen to open the wrong door. If there was such an alien invasion, it was a long time ago now, and it was silent, overwhelming, completely effective. It is still striking deep inland from its beachheads, and building new dolls for new walk-on parts in cyberspace. Through people like Adamski, invading agendas reached their targets, and the future was born. We don't have to be internet addicts to see agendas as pure disembodied information fields that are alien life forms in themselves. Adamski was in all likelihood seduced by a phenomenon that was pure manipulated suggestion. The kind of web-like information field that will replace eventually all pulleys, levers, and even our beloved electronic pulsations. His achievement is that he was one of the first to introduce the world to levels of post-industrial power as pure suggestion, performance, mimicking and virtual products, which last not more than a minute of old crankshaft time. In the sense that he introduced ideas of power and control as cool things and not old Hitler hot, he was a highly significant first modern. The age was changing in Adamski's head, and one such head is enough. Time in that sense exists in very few individuals. Like Yali of Melanesia, he was to be left marooned and confused, time dropped him and he could not complete his stories. But perhaps initiation of the first stories is sufficient. After that, the mission of such a manic information animal as Adamski is complete. His offspring were the eggs of a story virus. Death comes only when the story cycle has lodged within the host. Then our teller of tales must go on to other story cycles beyond the sun and moon. Like Shakespeare, he leaves his fast-breeding stories behind as a form of immortality. Adamski created a permanent pan-dimensional masterwork, his books, his films, and his photographic collection. Seen as a whole, this complex is as good as any in the 20th century artistic portfolio. Just like his distant mentor, Charles Fort, Adamski's images serve as modern protective talismans against all solutions, singular or final, partial or elegant. He is a major constituent of the strange power of the UFO. Even young skeptics of a very different generation jump up and down like natives round a beating drum and take extreme counter-ritualizing measures against his very name. Meantime, contactees keep faith. They worship bits of very odd metal, unusual plastic, strange implants, and even a tasteless biscuit or two for similar protection against old industrial fact. Against the western twilight, they hold up these hosts and watch the sky. Chapter 10. Entertainment State is born. It can be seen by now that 1953 was a vintage year for Adamski. The American edition of Flying Saucers Have Landed appeared in late 1953, and it received as much popular acclaim as it had earlier in Britain.